once you hit the magic number of 40, it's my belief that bike fits probably every 1 to 3 years, depending on your genetics and your tissue quality, are fairly paramount to maintaining your ability to cycle.
Welcome to the Athlete's Compass podcast. Each week, renowned sports scientist and founder of Athletica AI, Dr. Paul Larson, athlete, coach, and sports scientist Mariana Rakai, and coach and cyclist Paul Warlowski discuss training, racing, and improving your health and fitness. Get ready for your journey to peak performance. Hello and welcome to the Athlete's Compass podcast, where we navigate training, fitness, and health for everyday athletes. Today, we are honored to welcome Dr. Stacy Brixen to the podcast. Dr. Brixen, who is in Madison, Wisconsin, has spent 30 years as a physical therapist and athletic trainer. She is also a certified bike fitter and a USA Cycling Level 1, or the advanced coach. She has done 6 Ironmans and a lot of great gravel racing. So we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion today. Welcome, Stacy. How are you?
I am well. Thanks, Paul. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Stacy, let's start with bike fitting. Why are bike fits important, especially for people over 40? How much does bike fit play into aligning the physiology, training, and injury prevention?
It's probably a loaded question since I'm a bike fitter. So, of course, I think it's the ultimate thing that everyone should have. I would say bike fitting, obviously, when we all start riding as kids, we don't have a bike fit. Right? We're 4, 5, 6, 7, and there's no discussion of bike fit. So when it becomes important is when the mileage and the watts start to really make a difference. And so I don't know that that has an age. It's different for everybody. But for sure, once you hit the magic number of 40, it's my belief that bike fits probably every 1 to 3 years, depending on your genetics and your tissue quality, are fairly paramount to maintaining your ability to cycle with as little risk for injury and as much gain of pain-free riding as possible. There are mechanical reasons for that. Just tissue quality-wise, collagen is, like everything with age, doesn't improve. So it tends to, I don't know, I tell my patients it looks like spaghetti after it's been boiled in the colander, right? It gets all wormy-like. It doesn't look like it is in the bag when you take it off the shelf, nice and straight in the line. So that, if you can imagine, is what your collagen does over time. And there's less spaghetti as well. So how that translates on the bike is you usually have less ability than you started with to do simple things like hip hinge. And so when you don't hip hinge, then you usually cheat and get that from your spine. And when you get that motion from your spine, especially if you don't have a core that can hold it solid, things just keep escalating. So you can end up with all sorts of issues that simply came from your hamstrings being less flexible. And we don't notice that. So doesn't matter how old I am. I'm old enough to have wrinkles, and I don't know when that happened. You know, I didn't just wake up one day and go, well, geez, look at that. So that change in tissue is very much what happens to your hamstrings and other things. You don't notice it. You don't feel it. You can't measure it day by day. But one day you wake up with a wrinkly face and poor hamstring flexibility, and you're like, wow, what happened? And so I really do think that bike fit is important for anybody who is increasing their volume, increasing their watts to a point where it becomes a big factor. The number of revolutions becomes important, and the power can create mayhem. Or like I said, anybody over 40 or anybody with a major life change. So pregnancy and childbirth, an injury, major or minor, to an unrelated part. You know, I'm always surprised people are surprised when they have, let's say, a rotator cuff injury, and all of a sudden their bike fit needs to be changed. And they're like, well, I'm not pedaling with my arms, but your contact point is now painful and it's causing perturbations in the system. So I think everybody needs a bike fit.
So Stacy, the first question I had when we were talking about it was like, well, what happens at 40? And I was like, oh yeah, you do change. And, cause my stature is, you know, I've always been 5'10", you know, 160 pounds. Well, I'm not 5'10 anymore. I'm 5'9". I couldn't believe it. Wow. Where did an inch go?
Right.
What the? So exactly. We do change. And of course, when we go into the physiology, we know that our cells turn over every 6 months. We're like a new person, you know, when we're the product of what we've eaten ultimately and the stresses and the adaptations that have occurred over those last 6 months. So we change, just to your point. So, yep.
So we have a listener question from Matthias from our forum to kind of continue this idea with the bike fit. What are the benefits and downsides of going for a more aggressive bike fit with a lower handlebar position? Slam that stem. I'm currently considering removing one or two spacers from under my handlebar. What do you think about that?
I mean, aero is everything, right? Drag is not our friend, but to what cost? You just have to weigh the benefit and the risks. So if there aren't any risks, if his mobility and flexibility and strength allows a more aggressive position, then it's okay to try that. But I wouldn't recommend that without a full musculoskeletal eval to make sure that you can handle that and possibly also not all at once. So micro changes over time rather than one big change on one day usually fare better for people. And engineering is not my area, so I'm getting a little bit out of my lane, but I would just think about what other ways can you increase your aerodynamics aside from slamming the stem, and see if you can perhaps make a little bit more aerodynamic gains without a huge change in the fit. So it's hard to know without seeing the person and seeing what their current setup is.
Yeah, and I think you also have to think about like what is the person's goal, right? 108, like if he's doing an Ironman, I would say instead of pushing for aerodynamics, you have to be comfortable enough to be on aero as much as you can. Like you can see these amazing aerodynamic positions. But what do people end up doing is to sit up because they can't hold it at the, you know, after half of the Ironman bike ride because they can't hold it anymore, or that they walk because they're just toast from being hunched up in the aero position. That was not comfortable.
Stacey, I have a question, and it relates. It's all questions are always selfish for me, but it's like I'm one of those individuals. Obviously, I've got a little bit of a desk job sometimes with the work that I do, and I think the majority of our listeners are probably in that same sort of boat, right? How does that contribute, you know, with your background as PT and whatnot, to, you know, I don't know, just like this hunched over kind of position, right? Like I go and I ride loads of K's and then I come and sit at my desk and I'm kind of in the same sort of position. How does that lifestyle attribute to changes in the body that you've seen over time?
It probably second only to genetics is what we do for a living as far as repercussion. So, I won't throw my husband under the bus, but he's an orthopedic surgeon and you can tell what he does for a living just by looking at him because he's spent 30 years with loops, you know, hunched over, and then he cycles. So the poor guy, you know, I talked to him about posture and he's like, do you know what I do for a living? I think it is, exercises are great. You know, we can certainly give people exercises to reverse the postural habits that we have. Paul sits up while I'm talking to him. But if you're stretching your pecs and you're strengthening your scapular stabilizers 3 times a week for 20 minutes, that is not going to offset the habit itself. So a lot of times with people that I see, it's giving the right exercises, but more it's giving cues throughout the day to do what you just did, Paul, which is to sit up straight. And with all of the ergonomic technology we have, it really shouldn't be a big ask. You know, it's more just breaking the habit more than it is a magic exercise. Now that said, when you're on a bike for as many hours as you are, there is not much workaround. But back to bike fit, you should be fit to your bike so that you aren't in a rounded shoulder position. And so certainly as you fatigue, you're going to fall into postures that are unbecoming. But at least having the posture from the start with a bike fit that allows you, to the extent that your musculoskeletal system allows it, to be what I call neutral. So just gravity is working evenly throughout. It's not pulling more in one place than another because you're slouched or rounded, is really the essence. So bike fit, back to the first where we started.
Yeah. Okay, so how is it even possible to be comfortable on the bike when you're riding long hours? Like, I hear this question all the time. Like, are you even comfortable? Like, are you not sore? And I'm like, yeah, like my son, 14-year-old, he asked, like, Mom, how can you bike so long? Like, doesn't it hurt? I'm like, hell yeah, it does. But I don't, like, is it even possible to be comfortable?
Yes and no. I think that, so the longest race, single day race I've done is 312K. And there's no part of that that was uncomfortable at the start. There was every part that was uncomfortable towards the end. So the body is a machine and it has limits. So if you push it long enough, of course, at some point, it's going to bark back at you. But if you start uncomfortable, that's where bike fit should, it should be comfortable to start. And I have lots of people that come in and they say, well, I just thought it was supposed to be uncomfortable. And I think that is unfortunate. If you don't have a saddle that you're comfortable in from the start, nothing is going to feel good in short order. Aside from the bike fit, just the saddle itself and its interface with you, because you're constantly going to be moving around. So I always tell people, if you don't have a comfortable saddle, don't bother with the bike fit beyond that, because it's a moot point. And saddle should be comfortable. Absolutely. There is no reason to ride a saddle that doesn't love your geometry and you love the saddle geometry's back. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I was just going to say, like, if you're training for Ironman, like Mariana often does, you got to put in the K's, and you don't want to go on race day without preparing for 5-6 hours on the bike, right? Like, so to build up to that, you probably need to go through some level of discomfort, as you progress towards 3, 4, 5 hours. That's a unique position to hold for that length of time, but does get better with training as well, I've found. And to your point, of course, be comfortable to start.
And it's just like anything. I mean, I grew up on a farm and I haven't farmed for a long time, but last weekend my mom needed some help. And so I went back and I'm doing what you do. And oh my gosh, I could hardly function the next day. And she's 20 years older than I am and still functions fine. But I got away from it. So I can't expect to come back to it and put in a full day and not be really uncomfortable. And cycling is no different. To Paul's point, if you're going to be expected in an Ironman to be on a bike for, 4 to 6 hours, you can't just, and everyone knows this is listening, this is silly, but you can't just show up and expect after doing 2 that 4 to 6 is going to be comfortable. So you have to build into it. But I think everyone understands that well.
Yeah. I was also going to mention too, I was having to think about your posture thing, and I'm blessed to live in the hills and the mountains. And I love my hill rides just because I can get out of the saddle kind of repeatedly on every little switchback. There's a little bit of a steep part. And I look forward to them because it's like, oh, it just feels so good, right? I'm not running anymore. I ran probably too much. I wore out the tires in my hips, and they're going to need some love from the orthopedic surgeons in the future. But it's like, it's so nice to just be able to kind of stand in those things. So that mix of sitting and standing, I love so much more.
Yeah, that's interesting. We did Wisconsin had a ride across Wisconsin, and it's changed, but long ago you could ride the whole state, you know, 200 and some miles. And I swear to gosh, they picked every non-hilly road imaginable. And people are like, well, this is great. We have no hills. And I thought, this is awful. We have no hills because, like you said, we rely on undulating terrain to get out of our saddle. Not that you can't on a flat, but you're more inclined to just, you know, stay low and go. I love hills, and I love just undulating terrain for that reason. It's more comfortable, not less comfortable.
Mariana, do you love hills? You showed me a nice photo there yesterday.
Oh, I love the mountains. I don't get too many of those in Texas, so I'm embracing it while I can.
So, Stacey, we had another listener question from Kimber, and I think these two questions are pretty similar. At least, can you recommend 1 to 2 easy wins to get people started and then get them converted to decide to go to a fitter? And then for those who can't afford a fit right now, what are 2 things that people can do as a bridge until they can get a real fit?
So let me understand. There's 2 parts to the question. The first was, is it okay to just have people ride and then convince them of a fit rather than mandating a fit at the beginning? Is that kind of what you were asking?
Yeah, it sounds that way. And it sounds like, you know, what are some easy wins that somebody say, hey, do this, and this is going to convince you to get a fit in the future.
I see. And to be clear, I don't necessarily recommend anyone have a bike fit from the start if they're not familiar with cycling. In part, you don't know what it's supposed to feel like. So for example, I've been biking for 30 years, but just 5 years ago started mountain biking. I had no idea, you know, what that was supposed to feel like. So it took me a whole season before I had a bike fit because I didn't even know what felt wrong and what felt right. So I think to her point, yes, it's absolutely fine. Just a word of caution though, make sure that if you're buying a bike, even if you don't have a fit, that at least someone has eyes on you to make sure the size is right. Because obviously later you it's going to be an expensive oops if you have a fit and you realize that the size was wrong. So I would just say that. A few easy wins. I would just have, if a person's not sure what a bike fit's going to do, if they're clipped in, you can have them futz with their cleats. Really quickly, they're going to see that changing cleat position very rapidly translates to things feeling very different up the chain at the knees and the hips. You can have them pretend that their bars are really narrow, and then you can have them, you know, just to emphasize the importance of bar width, you can have them ride in the hoods and ride in the drops and get a sense of, okay, if these were in different orientations or different lengths or different, how would that feel on my shoulders? I don't know how else you could have them raise their seat a little bit higher than they think is normal. They could lower their seat a little bit lower than they think is comfortable and very easily get a sense of what that does to hip and knee range of motion, you know, excursion, power development. So I think just fiddling with those factors and those contact points could help them become more aware of what those contact points and perfect position might offer them.
I was going to say the same sort of thing there, Stacey. So you guys might have heard of Steve Neal. He's a bit of a famous cycling coach, and he just lives down the road from me. Came over with his VO2 Max machine, rode a VO2 Max in the lab here. And then, you know, coach's eye, he was like, I think, you know, Paul, you want to, yeah, I wasn't extending enough and whatnot. And he's like, you might just want to try experimenting, to Stacey's point, of just increasing that seat height by a millimeter and then another millimeter kind of thing. And I did that over a couple different rides, and it it definitely felt a lot better. And I wasn't, I don't know, as cramped up as I was initially. So, but again, to Stacy's point, it's pretty tough to you sort of need that experienced eye, I think, to help you out from the beginning, I would think.
Yeah, and then Paul, the second part of her question was, I think, the expense and are there workarounds? Bike fits are expensive if they're done correctly. A good bike fit takes us 3 hours and it's on the order of $300. And that's not a trivial amount of money for anyone. There are plenty of parameters out there that are pretty easy to figure out on your own. So if you have a simple camera and tripod and you can film yourself, on a trainer, you can pretty easily look at the hip and knee and foot angles and see if you're in the ballpark. I would say that's one fairly, it certainly doesn't cost anything. I don't know how effective it is. There are plenty of programs that are free apps that you can use that measure those angles for you and resources to tell you where they should be. I don't love my answer, but I think that's the best I can come up with.
Mm-hmm. No. I mean, we're obviously a pretty heavy tech company. So is there anything around the bike fit biomechanical analysis area that you're seeing, Stacy, that is maybe has a promise for the future?
Yeah, but I'm not well versed in the names if you're asking for specific apps. Because I don't know if this is good or bad, but I am so old school. We don't use 3D cameras. And I've fiddled with a lot of the apps. And honestly, unless you're in a research setting where you have a profound amount of money to have high-speed cameras, I don't find them that valuable. The only value I really see in them is showing the video back to the client so that they're able to see what you're seeing and you're able to show them what you did by changing what you changed. But they're not research grade. And depending on where you put the markers, I mean, you're off by more degrees than what you're measuring, right? They're really, so that's why I think I'm struggling with this answer a bit.
That's okay.
Yeah. Anything else on bike fit that we should talk about? I mean, obviously we could talk a whole episode just on bike fit, but anything else that you want to add to that, Stacy?
I think the only thing I would add is if your bike fit's perfect and you haven't aged a day and you're starting to experience a pain that you're not able to account for. So you didn't change training load, you didn't change intensity, you didn't go out and do something unusual. It's worth maybe not bike fit, but just having your bike run through a mechanical check. Because so many times I see in patients, they come in and they say, gosh, knee pain out of nowhere. And you look and their nose of their saddle is just dumped forward, 2 to 4 degrees. And so they're pushing back to stay out of that nose down and they're ending up with a patellar tendonitis or patellar tendinopathy. That's a really common one. Or they slowly just start to have nagging of knee pain and you look and their cleats are worn. So a lot of times the bike changed and caused something to ache or pain on you. And that's another reason, I think, to just pay attention to both bike fit and then just bike mechanics to make sure that something didn't go awry.
Stacy, I have a question that you're no doubt somewhat of an expert on, and it relates to one touch point, a key touch point, and that's the saddle. Like, how does saddle selection? What does saddle selection strategy look like from your expert standpoint that you can recommend for us? Right, like the layperson, where do they start?
I think you find either a bike shop or a bike fitter that has the basic shapes. So to back up, saddles are by far the hardest thing. And there's all sorts of pressure mapping and I don't have any experience with those. I think they're very promising. But at the nuts and bolts of the issue, you have a pelvic geometry.
Oh, here comes the visual.
All right.
This is my husband's, and this is back from his med school days. This is a real one. These are lacking in today's world. But, wow. You know, pelvic geometry, basically, you've got your, you know, your sits bones, which you're not riding on unless you're Elvira Gulch and Wizard of Oz. You're really trying to ride these rails, right? Yeah, you want every contact point, every available contact point from those rails to be on the firm part of the saddle. And if that doesn't happen, bad things are going to happen, right? So the name of the game is to figure out your pelvic width, meaning the distance between the rails, the width of the rails, and how fast those rails come to a point, and find a saddle that fits that exactly. So width is the first thing. How fast the cutout goes from wide to narrow is the second thing. Where it's puffy and where it's not puffy, right? So if you're sitting on a part of the saddle that everyone thinks is, not everyone, that most people think is good, that's just pushing up on the soft tissue and causing neurovascular problems. So you want your rails on a hard part of the saddle. And the reason that a lot of the mapping is difficult and saddle fit is difficult is as you fatigue, your posture changes. And as your posture changes, where you are on those rails and where those rails are on the saddle changes. So it's not just finding a saddle that feels good the first 2 hours. It's a saddle that as you change your posture with fatigue, feels good 4 to 6 hours. So you need to find a saddle shop that has all the shapes, right? And the widths. So wide to narrow, and then concave, convex, flat, snub nose, cutouts, no cutouts. Those are sort of the basics. And you circle through them and you circle through them. And if right away it feels awful, that shape and that width is out. If right away it feels like, that's out. If right away it feels like, yes, that's maybe in. And so it's rare that I can figure out if the saddle is right or wrong in a 3 hour fit. It's often, yep, the saddle feels great now. You take it home, you ride it, you bring it back. And so having test saddles in the various widths and shapes is great. Most bike shops, that just doesn't work well for them, right? They're retail, so they don't really want you to bring back a nice but slightly used saddle and keep doing that. Nope. So finding a, like I work with Colin O'Brien, who's one of the most renowned fitters in the world. And at his shop, Chrono Metro, we've just got a whole saddle library. And it's just, that's how it is, right? You come in, you check out a book from the library, you take it home, you bring it back, and that's how this goes. So if anyone's looking for a simple solution, I sure don't have it. And we're working with people who know what a good saddle fit should feel like. When you're first learning, how do you tell people, like, it's really awkward, especially if it's a man and a woman or a woman and a man, to like be like, here's your rails. This is what you should feel, you know, like, let me just show you. So that's why models are great. But it is the hardest part of bike fit. And I think probably the most essential starting point. So find a shop, preferably a bike fit shop, that has test saddles and test them out. And then once you think you have one that is not objectionable, go from there.
You mentioned the differences between men and female, like women have a little bit wider pelvis. There are quite a bit of female specific saddles, but do you see any other differences between men and females?
That's a great question. The saddles, saddles are a little bit like saying this is a female bike. It just mostly says, you know, in general, on a bell-shaped curve, you're a different size and shape. So I never steer men away from women's saddles, and I never steer women directly towards women's saddles. I just, they're a shape and they're a size that I throw into the mix. Other than pelvic geometry, the biggest thing I think is ligamentous laxity, particularly hormonally with your cycle, you know, relaxin, all those lovely hormones that allow us to have an accommodating place for a baby are different than the hormones men have. And so I do think that there's a little bit of cyclical stuff that goes on. I don't think that warrants a different saddle every so often. It's just one consideration that isn't present in men. And boy, our not just our pelvic structure, but our plumbing is very different. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a whole different set of things I hear from males and females. And because I'm female, I think I understand that female anatomy better. That's one really nice thing working with Colin is we have a his and a hers. And that's really helpful for the patients or the patients, if I see them for PT, clients, if I see them for bike fit, just to talk to somebody about, all right, this is the problem. This is where I'm experiencing pressure or pain. And it's just nice to talk to somebody that has your same anatomy to help you work through that. So yeah, the plumbing is just different. I would say I have a lot more males that ride like the Cobb saddle. I call it the snub nose. Whether that's plumbing or not, I'm not sure, but that's a big difference that I see. And probably a lot more females in my experience that ride with a cutout than males.
Stacy, I want to just take a left turn for just a moment and talk about your work with Velocity and Draft Responsibly. Community is an important part of what you do and what you try to build. Can you talk to us about, we're trying to get things going with Velocity, and how has that evolved for you?
I have nothing but good things to say about Velocity. So you're right. My cycling group, coaching aside, is called Brickos Drafters, and we have 189 cyclists at this point that we've built over 14 years. And it's more of a family than it is a race team or anything else. And so cycling together is really important to us. And it's a challenge, right? And I've been at this long enough to remember way back in the days when cycling together meant Johnny G spinners. You remember those? They're basically the old Monarch bicycle that's what we would use to train. And then things got more sophisticated and CompuTrainer came around, and that was fantastic. We could all be in a room with cords running everywhere because CompuTrainers were hardwired but it allowed us to train in the same room and with power, which was great. And then the next evolution was smart trainers at home that didn't have wires and Zwift and Trainer Road and all the other platforms. And that became great. A lot of people lobbed on to that. It wasn't so great for my group. That's really it's not isolating. You're biking with people you don't know in a group, but for our purposes, it was very isolating. And so Velocity has allowed us to come together in a room again on our bikes and train in a meaningful way. And what I mean by that is two things. One, I can see in real time what everyone is doing. So when I'm teaching a class, they're physically in front of me and they're also at home. So now I lose the problem of only having 13 bikes or 13 trainers in our studio. So I've got 13 people in front of me and I've got as many as want to sign up for the class at home. And I can see in real time on my computer screen, just like I can see you now, their faces and their boxes, and it's color coded. So, you know, green is go. Green is they're doing what I'm asking. And then if it's too hot, I think it's red. And if it's too cold, it's blue or something like that. And so I don't have to be with my old eyes looking at numbers, like what's their FTP number? What's their heart rate? It just lights it up on a color coded scheme. So I can quickly assess if people are on target or off target. And the people can see each other. Right. So I've got 13 in front of me and I've got however many at home and we're all biking as a group. I love that. Absolutely love that. It is not intimidating for people who don't use power. So I have many athletes that don't use power and there's still a part of it because those graphs come up in heart rate targets and they come up in RPE targets. Which makes it also very easy for me because when I'm trying to give a meaningful explanation for a workout, I don't have to speak in the different languages. Well, for you, it's heart rate here. For you, it's power here. For you, it's RPE here. it's all one and the same. It under the program understands all of those metrics and can just show it in color.
If I can take it from there.
Yeah.
So shoes, we have shoes, insoles. We're kind of getting this nice picture of exactly what point contact points and what a good bike feeder can help you out with. We haven't talked about leg length differences. Like a lot of people have different length of their legs. How do you deal with that?
Oh boy. So leg length discrepancy is tricky. You only know if you have a leg length discrepancy if you had a full length radiograph. Mm-hmm. So unless you've had an x-ray, you don't know where it's coming from or if it's true or if it's pseudo leg length discrepancy, which can often and most frequently does happen when you have just a torsion of the pelvis. So quick and dirty, you know, I sort of have a person supine and you pull on their hips and you do your little magic and you see if their malleoli line up. But if they don't, you flex them to 90 and you have them bridge and you do it again. And usually that changes things a little bit. And if it looks like a true leg length discrepancy, which I can only measure not very accurately with a tape measure from, you know, like ASIS to your points. If they have it documented, or if I really think it's a leg length discrepancy, maybe I'll shim it, not quite to the full LLD, but to part of that. Most times I handle it with exercise, with trying to decrease whatever the rotational or torsion is that's creating it. So I'm very reluctant to just see a discrepancy and shim it, especially if they're not having any functional sequela of that. So, you know, the big things that you see in riders that make me nervous, you know, the rocking of the pelvis, that is rarely due to a leg length discrepancy. That's usually due to either they hate their saddle, they don't know how to engage their core, their crank length is way off, their saddle height is way off. I don't know in 30 years that I've treated a leg length discrepancy as such. So I'm careful with that one.
Yeah, and that's a really good point because having a bike fitter who is also physio can, you know, can see the real cause and not just like, you know, label it as leg length discrepancy.
Yeah, I mean, if let's say you have a pseudo short right leg and you think, well, I'm just going to throw a shim in there. Well, if it's not truly a leg length discrepancy, what you just did is give that part of the body permission to get shorter, right? You're just like, I just brought the ground to you and it goes, oh, super, because I'm going to take it up another notch, right? So you can feed the fuel for a really bad fire if you just start shimming things that you're not clear why you're shimming them. Now, I may shim something that I know on purpose shouldn't be shimmed to give that tissue rest, knowing full well I'm going to unshim it. So if I'm bringing the ground up to something because it's shortened and it's angry, I might allow that body to stay shortened to quiet it down so that off the bike, I can address what's making it angry and lengthen it. And as that length comes back, then I take out the shim. So it's, I'm not saying that I don't shim something that shouldn't, that I'm very careful to shim for a reason, not just to, you know, whack-a-mole, try to fix something that's moving and not really understanding why it's moving in that way.
Yeah.
Yes.
And maybe in the future, Stacey, you will come and host a session with me. I would love to.
Yes, please.
I would love to. Thank you.
Right. Well, Stacey, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your wisdom on bike fits and community. Thank you for stopping in today.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to meet you all. Paul and Mariana, and Paul, of course, I know you from before, so still nice to see you.
Thank you, Stacey. Awesome conversation. Learned a heap. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care, all.
Bye.
Thanks for listening today to the Athlete's Compass podcast. Take a moment now, subscribe, share, and let's keep navigating this endurance adventure together. Improve your training with the science-based training platform Athletica and join the conversation at the Athletica Forum. For Dr. Stacey Brixen, Mariana Rakai, and Dr. Paul Larson, I'm Paul Worlowski, and this has been the Athlete's Compass Podcast. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed another episode of the Athlete's Compass Podcast, your North Star through the sometimes complicated world of training for your endurance sport. We appreciate your comments and training questions and your 5-star reviews. For a deeper dive into the science of endurance sports, listen to the Training Science Podcast and check out the adaptive AI training platform athletica.ai. Thanks for listening.